From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Media reports that President Donald Trump was last year briefed on the Russian government offering the Taliban bounties for the lives of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan have provoked widespread outrage. Trump claimed he was not briefed, but was proven lying after documented evidence to the contrary. Newspaper op-eds have demanded answers, as of current and former officials like Senator Tammy Duckworth and former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, both of whom are contenders for Joe Biden's running mate. But Congress just authorized an amendment introduced by GOP Congresswoman Liz Cheney that would prolong the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, where we have fought the longest war in modern American history. My guest is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali.
So before we get into the broader question of what the true agenda is of Congress when they have, you know, sort of supported this war on both sides of the aisle, let's talk specifically about the story of the Russian government offering bounties to Taliban soldiers. Honestly, it doesn't sound terribly unrealistic considering the history of both the U.S. and Russia and previously the USSR in Afghanistan, right? The governments of both these countries have often used cold, hard cash to buy and sell the allegiances of fundamentalist warlords.
Yeah, I think that that history is really important, you know, and so on one hand, yes, there's reason to see this as valid. We also know that neither government has come forward and claimed that it's true, and that also makes sense. It makes sense that they wouldn't. My concern with the conversation is that the notion that people in Afghanistan would have to be paid to attack U.S. soldiers, there's something about that ignores what the reality of the two decades long U.S. occupation, you know, invasion and occupation of Afghanistan have actually looked like. That is, the idea that people would be required to be bribed or paid to attack U.S. soldiers ignores just how devastating this war has been. And so, of course, it's good to be concerned with the lives of U.S. personnel. Of course, the best way to save their lives is to withdraw all of them from Afghanistan. But it's important actually to center what is going on to Afghan people. And if you do that, if you look at the tens of thousands of Afghans who've been killed as part of the U.S. invasion and subsequent occupation, the many who've been wounded, the many who've been displaced, and so on, it paints a very different picture than I think is being discussed in the mainstream media.
U.S. soldiers would be in danger from the Taliban, from ISIS, from anybody in Afghanistan, simply because they are in Afghanistan, right? An easy way to protect troops would be to bring them home.
Right. I mean, that's precisely it. So what we are at the moment, the U.S. is involved in the withdrawal plan that it's negotiated with the Taliban. And at the moment, that leaves 8,600 troops in Afghanistan. I mean, that is the reduced number. And so the question is, why are there any troops there at all? You know, why is the U.S. not withdrawing completely? And then any kind of repair that needs to be done, that's what we should be talking about, is a post-U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Whereas, in fact, at the moment, the U.S. is maintaining its presence, and that should never have begun, but certainly should be ended.
Let's also talk about the fact that the outrage from liberals and even some conservatives around the story of Russian bounties seems to be centered on this anger that the Trump administration is once more somehow capitulating to Russia's government under Vladimir Putin. This seems to fit nicely within this idea that Trump is a Putin stooge, that Russia has been manipulating the U.S. government under Trump. Do you feel that that seems to be the bigger outrage here?
Well, that's really essential to talk about, because that is actually, you know, of course, there's a number of things happening domestically in the U.S. Regarding President Trump and his approval rating and disapproval and so on that this is connected to. But the bigger geopolitical context is an ongoing tension and really rivalry, friction between the U.S. and Russia. And truthfully, in general, the U.S., the people who run this country, they believe in that Russia is an adversary. You know, even the Trump administration, you know, Trump rhetorically, in his words, he'll say good things about Vladimir Putin. In practice, the Trump administration has actually invested more money and otherwise made greater investments in the U.S. military presence in Europe, in Eastern Europe, precisely to counter Russia.
Which is a continuation of Obama's policy toward Russia, right?
That is exactly right. There's something called the European Deterrence Initiative that was begun in 2014 under the Obama administration. And the idea was actually to invest more militarily on the part of the United States, precisely to send a message to Russia and to really counter Russian militarism and assert U.S. militarism in that region. So that was begun under Obama. And that first year, the budget was $985 million. The height of the program, the height of its funding, was in 2019 when that sum increased to $6.5 billion. That was under Trump. And just this past year, that figure was $5.9 billion. So whatever Trump is saying about Putin, in practice, it is the Department of Defense under Trump that is taking action that really escalate tensions with Russia, at the same time as the U.S. is conducting military exercises in the Arctic Circle, in the Mediterranean and elsewhere that are, on one hand, are routine in the sense that the U.S. always believes that it has the right to exercise its military everywhere, but is also quite explicitly being directed at Russia. So that kind of geopolitical tension and conflict is really the backdrop in a lot of ways. And then at the same time, there is a kind of partisan dimension to it where, yes, the Democrats are portraying Trump as a stooge of Putin. That has, on one hand, there has been a situation where Trump has believed Putin publicly, of course, over his own intelligence agencies, which is interesting. It has also been convenient for the Democrats, actually, to have this kind of narrative. This is how they explained how Hillary Clinton lost the last election and so on. So this is all the context, I think. And, you know, Afghans whose lives are at stake when we talk about the U.S. presence, that's actually who we really need to be talking about here in center.
And all of that can be true. Trump holding, you know, Russia or having a hard line on Russia in continuation of the Obama administration. And it can also be true that he doesn't care about U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And frankly, it doesn't seem neither that Congress does either, except for the handful of representatives in the House. Actually, both sides of the aisle, Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, who were among the handful of representatives who opposed the amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act brought by Liz Cheney, Representative Liz Cheney, that is called something to the effect of an oversight act. It is called the Afghanistan Partnership and Transparency Act, introduced by Jason Crow, a Democrat, Liz Cheney, and others. That particular amendment to the NDAA would essentially, I understand, prolong the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. And members of Congress who claim to care about the lives of U.S. troops mostly voted for it.
Right. I mean, this it reveals so much. You have an invasion that never should have happened to begin with, and an occupation that has gone on for two decades. And it is evident that the U.S., not only is it indefensible from a humanitarian standpoint, what the United States has done and is doing in Afghanistan, it is also clear that the U.S. actually does not have a strategy to win, that even from a military standpoint, they cannot actually win this war. I think it's clear, this is true generally, but particularly if you look at Afghanistan, the people who run this country are not sure what to do. They don't have a plan. In the absence of the plan, they will continue to prolong a military occupation. Now, the plan that they have put forward, which is the training of the Afghan forces, that is a U.S.-backed and armed force that can carry out the objectives that the U.S. claims to have had when it invaded Afghanistan, that has also, again, not only not winning militarily, but has been catastrophic from a humanitarian standpoint. Actually, just days ago, members of the Afghan forces in Helmand province actually attacked a cattle market, killing dozens of people with mortars. And so this is supposed to be their plan, to have Afghans take over what the U.S. has done with American assistance and American weapons and so on. And this is a disaster for Afghan people. So once again, we have to center those people when we talk about the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and bring all of the U.S. troops home.
I want to just quote Senator Mitt Romney, who is, you know, now considered part of the left flank of the Republican Party, in responding to the story about Russian bounties on the heads of U.S. soldiers. He said, "What we do know is Russia's been helping the Taliban. The Taliban's been killing Americans. And that's all I need to know that we should be tough on Russia." So his conclusion was that we should be tough on Russia rather than concluding that the Afghanistan war is a very dangerous war for U.S. troops, for ordinary Afghans, for almost everybody involved. What I'm also interested in analyzing, Corey, is how all of this plays into the supposed deal, the peace deal that the U.S. has been engaged in with the Taliban to withdraw U.S. troops. This was very much in the news. And right. Donald Trump, who has really been one of the worst war hawk presidents, you know, who's unleashed the U.S. military, has also had these bizarre contradictions when it comes to North Korea and now Afghanistan, where he has actually tried to or made some moves to end tensions and war. And he's right. been opposed by Congress on these issues.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, you know, to the extent that Trump is interested in, disentangling U.S. military involvement in different regions of the world, of course, it's not out of any kind of concern for the humanitarian price that ordinary people in those regions, whether on the Korean Peninsula or in Afghanistan or elsewhere in Central Asia or the Middle East, that Trump is not concerned with those things. He is, I think, putting this forward. I think there's two things. One is there is a kind of he wants to have what they would call a foreign policy victory that he can then hold up and say that he has achieved peace in the Korean Peninsula, or he has achieved the deal of the century with Palestine, or whatever, that he can say that I have solved this longstanding problem. But the other thing is there actually is a kind of geopolitical thought to it, the idea that, okay, if the U.S. can withdraw from one or more places, then that will position it better for these longer term battles, in particular with China, who across the board, Trump, other Republicans, Democrats are all united in terms of a longer conflict with China. So that's all really horrifying. Just to circle back to what you asked about Mitt Romney, and you know, all he needs to know in terms of Russia supporting the killing of Americans via the Taliban. You know, this is always true, but now more than ever, it's really important that we talk about the actual history of U.S. involvement, U.S. violence in Afghanistan. It's important to talk about the context from which the Taliban emerged, which was a context that the United States played a pretty significant role in. It was the United States that funded Islamist fundamentalist fighters when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan in the 1980s. It was the United States that funneled weapons and wealth to do that kind of thing. And it was the crisis that the United States played a role in from which the Taliban and, by the way, organizations like Al-Qaeda emerged. So this kind of short-sightedness, I think
hypocrisy,
that,
I mean, let's just say.
It's hypocrisy because for those of us who are just trying to understand the situation, it's a kind of that short-sighted narrow view will not help us. For people who bear responsibility for the situation, it's actually very convenient that we're not talking about this history, but we need to.
So at this point, what needs to happen from the point of view of progressives like Ro Khanna, who have opposed the continuation of the U.S. war in Afghanistan? It's kind of shocking to think about Ro Khanna and Trump on the same side as one another when it comes to the Afghanistan war. It seems as though the American people, who are sort of understandably preoccupied by a pandemic, by mass protests and police brutality, are not really thinking about the Afghanistan war. But there is a huge connection to be made, right? Because Congress holds the purse strings, and the amendment that I've been mentioning was to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is Congress giving our tax dollars, when we need them so much here in the United States, to continue this war in another part of the world that has yielded no results.
Right. Well, you know, Sonali, what you said a minute ago, which is that the kind of the takeaway, I think, of this conversation as it exists in the halls of power in Washington, the takeaway is the U.S. should actually commit more to its occupation in Afghanistan. The U.S. should double down on that occupation, and actually the U.S. should escalate its militarism toward Russia, too. Again, always catastrophic, always indefensible, but in the midst of a pandemic is just, it's unconscionable. And that said, I do think that we have a new opportunity in this country, not only because of the catastrophe of the pandemic, the toll that it has taken in this, the wealthiest country in the world, which is not only was completely unprepared, but continues to fail in terms of responding to the crisis of COVID-19 here. So that is part of the context. But of course, we also have this nationwide Black-led uprising, which has shifted the political conversation in the United States, which has said, you know, these institutions, these armed forces, in this case, police departments, who the idea is that they're somehow accountable to the people who live in the society, and yet clearly are unhinged, they're out of control. And actually, we should force an accountability by not only curtailing their actions, but by funding. I think that those of us who understand that there is a problem with U.S. violence domestically and abroad need to extend that conversation and say, also, the U.S. armed forces abroad need to be held accountable, actually. And we know that this war has only been catastrophic for people in Afghanistan. It has absolutely not helped people in this country, as you say, especially at the moment in a pandemic. And so I think that we need to actually raise our voices as we're calling for a demilitarization of the country domestically. We need to call for a demilitarization of U.S., what the U.S. does all around the world, and actually suspend military operations, and for Afghanistan in particular, bring the troops back.
You know, what you were saying really reminds me of the conversation around police violence as well, that when activists here had called on a defunding of police, it's not a new call, it's been actually going on for many years, the reaction from both liberals and conservatives had been to throw more money at the police, saying, oh, well, this actually means we need to give them more training, more equipment, more body cameras, which now we know has not worked. In some cases, it's made the problem worse. And similarly, in the foreign army, we have our domestic army in the form of police, and we have our foreign army in the platform of U.S. troops. It hasn't worked to throw more money at the problem. And in fact, it has even endangered U.S. troops themselves. And it's, you know, I'm wondering if you think that the U.S. corporate media is doing a good enough job of highlighting these links, of highlighting the money connection. I remember, you know, a few months ago, the Washington Post did a remarkable job of revealing the what were called the Afghanistan Papers. That's but right. That was, it seemed as though sort of an exception to the rule of how corporate media cover this war.
That's right. I mean, I think that what we are seeing, especially in the past year, you know, with the release of the Afghanistan Papers, with the, you know, despite the various failures of U.S. wars all around the world, the support on the part of Congress to attack Iran, which the U.S. has done in any number of ways and come close to escalating its attacks on Iran. What we have seen in terms of just months ago when the Iraqi parliament said, please leave, please withdraw from our country. And the United States said, no, we will not. I mean, what we're seeing is the resilience of the idea in Washington that the U.S. should wield this kind of power around the world, and the tremendous investment, which really, unfortunately, is across the aisle, you know, in terms of both parties, with some notable exceptions, like voices like Ro Khanna and Barbara Lee and, you know, Ilhan Omar and others. But there's a tremendous amount of investment, actually, in the various halls of power in Washington, and an investment on the part of the U.S. corporate media as well. There has been room for critique, and I think the Afghanistan Papers is one really excellent example. But that in and of itself, we're seeing, is not sufficient, actually, to change course. Now, that said, there's also tremendous investment in police power here in the U.S., and that is being shaken right now. It's being shaken by popular resistance, by mass uprising. And so I think that the lesson for those of us whose sights are on demilitarizing the United States, demilitarizing the U.S.'s presence in this world, let's take a lead from these protests, these Black Lives Matter protests in the streets, and say, okay, revolt is actually what it's going to take to do this and to shift the context so that these things that just weeks ago did not seem possible. A conversation about defunding and abolition did not seem possible weeks ago, and now are a public mainstream conversation. Doesn't mean that it'll be easy, but it is a completely different context when people are in the streets, and we need to rebuild that kind of resistance when it comes to U.S. wars.
Corey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people read your writings about foreign policy?
Sure. You can go. So I work at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can go to our website, ips-dc.org, and you can read the work of myself and my colleagues there.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
It's such a pleasure and an honor. Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the ongoing U.S. war in Afghanistan. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.